to a casual reader, you would come away from reading it saying, well, they proved it. They made their case. This barbaric terrorist organization did use rape systematically against Israeli women. And that was used to justify the continuation of the war on Gaza. But then, as you said, when the Daily tried to look closer at the article, they realized they couldn't actually stand up the claims that were being made in it. And so inside the Times, you have this extremely intense debate going on. And I think leaders at the Times have been surprised. They're used to external criticism, but the amount of internal criticism they're getting has them on the back foot.
And finally, Jeremy, we just have 30 seconds, but even the use of the term terrorist within the New York Times and the stepping back of one of the leading, editorial directors.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of concern right now, particularly among reporters, who do work on an international level, that there has been a politicization of this war internally within the newsroom that is impacting the coverage. And I think it's pretty clear. You can see that in some of the journalism. And now the New York Times. The New York Times has ended up walking back the major claim that they made, and now they're saying hedge words that may have occurred. That's one of the most significant things we uncovered here.
Jeremy Scahill and Ryan Grimm, they are the co-authors of the piece Between the Hammer and the Anvil.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Community Radio during the special programming campaign All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 3. This February and March, you will hear different marathons and series, all brought to you by our talented programmers, including marathons like our very own Bluegrass Marathon. If you'd like to help KBOO reach our $22,000 goal by March 16th, go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321 right now.
Check out Ear to the Streets of Portland with hosts Sequoina
and Kayla
every first and third Thursday of the month starting at 7 o'clock p.m.
Listen in as we interview community organizers, speak on issues focused on Black Portland, and share community events happening in the area and elsewhere.
Listen on the radio at 90.7 FM, online at www.kboo.fm, or from your mobile phone at m.kboo.fm.
Follow KBOO on Instagram at KBOO Radio. Ear to the Streets.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon Republican lawmakers bid to return after their walkout is denied by a federal appeals court.
The Portland Police Union ballot measure to remove the accountability board takes its next step.
And in national news, Alabama passes legislation to protect IVF.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 1st, 2024. I'm Josh Salem.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. A federal appeals court has now ruled that Oregon state lawmakers who walked out of the session in protest can lose their chance to run for re-election, as was written in Measure 113. In 2022, Oregon voters passed that measure, which prohibits lawmakers from running from re-election if they miss 10 days of work. Republican state senators walked out of the legislative session for 6 weeks in 2023. They've now challenged the law, saying it was poorly written and that their walkout was constitutionally protected. Last month, the Oregon Supreme Court denied their appeal, and now a three-judge panel from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals agrees. The decision read in part, quote, "Actions have consequences. When those actions might be described as expressive in nature, the First Amendment sometimes protects us from the repercussions that follow. This is not one of those instances," end quote. The filing deadline for the May primary is March 12th, so those senators who walked out, Dennis Linthicum of Klamath Falls and Brian Boquist of Dallas, won't have time to appeal further before the deadline. The Oregon Capitol Chronicle reports Linthicum's wife, Diane, has now filed to run in his place, and former state lawmaker Bruce Starr is running for Boquist's seat.
A measure proposed by Portland's rank-and-file police union has moved forward in the process to get on the November ballot. The initiative proposes a drastic change to the city charter language, mandating that the city create an independent police accountability system with the power to impose discipline. The current charter language is from a ballot measure passed by an overwhelming majority of city voters in 2020. Lawyers for the Portland Police Association submitted the current initiative to the city auditor last week, and today the city attorney submitted the official ballot title. The measure now enters the ballot title challenge period. If any registered Portland voter takes issue with the ballot title, they can file a challenge for review in the Multnomah County Court by March 12th. The 2020 measure outlined a police oversight system with the power to subpoena and discipline cops. It had the authority to review most complaints against police. It created a ban on the membership of current or former police, as well as a budget pegged to 5% of the police bureau budget. The Police Accountability Commission, or PAC, worked for 2 years to create a detailed proposal for a new system. The city attorney countered this late last year with a drastically scaled-back proposal. Both proposals would be abandoned if voters approve the PPA's charter language, which eliminates most of the powers and transparency of the 2020 version.
Whatever it winds up looking like, the new police oversight and accountability system will replace the current system, which centers around the Independent Police Review Division, or IPR. Though its days are numbered, IPR is still functioning and investigating complaints against police. The main venue for citizen involvement in the current accountability system is IPR's 11-member All-Volunteer Citizen Review Committee, or CRC, which hears and votes on appeals of police misconduct investigations. IPR is currently seeking applicants for open spots on the CRC to serve 3-year terms. Interested people need to apply by March 17th and can find the application and more information at portlandoregon.gov/IPR. If selected, they will need to be approved by City Council. Besides hearing appeals, CRC members have a rotating seat on the Police Review Board, where they are responsible for reviewing and voting on police misconduct and deadly force cases. The CRC holds monthly meetings on the first Wednesday of every month, though the meeting scheduled for March 6th has been canceled.
The Alabama House and Senate swiftly passed bills to protect in vitro fertilization in the state, but concerns have arisen over their limited time frame. Reproductive justice groups are asking for more comprehensive protection for families. Shantia Hudson has the latest.
The Alabama House and Senate both passed bills this week that would help people resume in vitro fertilization and provide legal protections for providers and patients in certain cases. Senate Bill 159 and its companion, House Bill 237, passed swiftly despite debates surrounding immunity and personhood. Heidi Miller with the reproductive justice group Yellowhammer Fund says while this is a positive step that allows families to resume treatments, they're still concerned with the limited time frame the bills offer.
So it just feels like a very limited solution to me. And that's our stance as an org, is that, you know, it feels like very much like a Band-Aid on an open wound. And so that's how we've kind of been looking at those bills, because Senator Melson's bill similarly would be repealed on April 1st, 2025.
Both bills would apply retroactively and be automatically repealed next year, which Miller says could affect families again. This comes after IVF programs around the state stopped offering the service over concerns about legal conduct consequences following an 8-1 state Supreme Court ruling. The court ruled that frozen embryos are protected by the state's Wrongful Death of a Minor Act that protects children regardless of location. Acknowledging the temporary nature of the bills, Miller argues a short-term solution is insufficient for people seeking IVF treatments, which sometimes can take months or years. She says they're urging lawmakers to take further action to safeguard the accessibility of IVF.
For us to get the constitutional amendment, the, you know, quote, sanctity of life constitutional amendment from 2018 back for a revote in front of Alabama voters, because that would be the long-term solution that would really protect IVF access.
She says unless the constitutional amendment is repealed, it could supersede any law or code, specifically where the term child or minor child is not defined. Miller says the Yellowhammer Fund has resources on its website for people who want to know more. House Minority Leader Anthony Daniels is sponsoring two measures, including a constitutional amendment to clarify that an extrauterine embryo should not be considered an unborn life or unborn child. For Alabama News Service, I'm Shantia Hudson.
Closer to home, a revision in the euthanasia policy at the troubled Multnomah County Animal Shelter, or MCAS, is raising alarm among local animal lovers and shelter volunteers. The Oregonian reports that the Department of Community Services, which oversees the shelter, created a completely new euthanasia policy from scratch in November. Previously, the shelter maintained a rule that clearly stated animals were not to be euthanized for a lack of space at the shelter. The new policy does not include that language, and instead says reasons for putting an animal down can consider, quote, available resources to manage or address the needs of the animal, as well as a lack of available placement opportunities. Advocates worry that the word changes of this new policy leave the door open for MCAS to euthanize healthy animals simply for space. Margie Bradway is the director of the Department of Community Services, which oversees MCAS. She says that while the shelter will never put a healthy animal to sleep to make room for incoming pets, the new policy was written to help better define what it means for an animal to be considered dangerous or unhealthy. Bradway says that animals are spending longer in the shelter since adoption rates are low and there are a high number of pet surrenders. This can cause them to deteriorate mentally and physically, making them candidates for euthanasia. Revising the animal shelter's euthanasia policy is part of the lengthy list of recommendations made for MCAS as a result of a 9-month review of the shelter ordered by County Chair Jessica Vega Peterson last year. The review was the result of ongoing issues at MCAS, which came to a head when the shelter had to close for a week in December of 2023 due to overcrowding and a lack of staff. Problems at the county shelter have been well documented since 2008 and include substandard animal care, neglect, understaffing, mismanagement, and a lack of accountability. MCAS put down 486 dogs and cats in 2023 and is also routinely criticized for a lack of proper record keeping and transparency when it comes to rationales for euthanizing animals.
An Oregon legislature plan to invest $376 million in the Emergency Housing Stability Production Package progressed this week. It's a package of three bills, which passed one committee on a bipartisan vote and is going to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means for more consideration. Senator Aaron Wood says the bill will assist renters, houseless people, and shelters. Legislatures looked across the state for projects and organizations that the bill could benefit. These include Urban League of Portland, Community Warehouse, and Project Turnkey. All of these groups support Oregon's houseless and low-income populations. The investments are aimed at preventing evictions, supporting new housing development, and funding rapid response programs. About $250 million will be used to build affordable housing for low-income families, people struggling with houselessness, and people recovering from a substance use disorder. Senator Dick Anderson says these investments are a good first step to solving the housing crisis. He says he's glad the funds are going directly to people all over Oregon, not just Portlanders. The bill also gives nearly $25 million in investments to support healthy and safe homes by funding home improvements that lower energy usage. Warming and cooling shelters are also receiving aid.
Grants Pass is a small, idyllic Oregon town in the foothills of the Cascades, where residents have long promoted their city's agreeable year-round climate. But when local officials sought to turn their slogan, "It's the Climate," into a sustainability plan, they ran into daunting problems with staffing and funding. The plan would transition publicly owned buildings and vehicles to renewable energy and diversify their power sources. J.C. Rowley, finance director for the city of Grants Pass, says the process of funding climate programs is highly competitive.
Yes, there are grants out there, but I don't think we're the only community out there looking for grants to help pay for some of these things. It's a lot more competitive than it was years ago.
Rowley says some projects outlined in the sustainability plan include installing vehicle charging stations, putting solar panels at two city facilities, and converting park streetlights to LEDs. He adds small rural towns often don't have the staff or budget that larger cities do to produce competitive grant applications. Much of the funding for projects like those for Grants Pass comes from the federal $87 billion Inflation Reduction Act passed last year. Karen Chase with the Energy Trust says rural cities face an uphill battle in finding the money for climate programs.
Having somebody to do this work is critical. We have rural communities that don't have grants writers, that may only have one or two paid staff. Most of my rural communities lost out because they didn't have the capacity to take advantage of it.
Through AmeriCorps, Allegra Starr at the Resource Assistance for Rural Environments program worked with the Grants Pass Task Force, and she says that elements of the plan are also designed to assist residents in case of a natural disaster.
In the event of a natural disaster, we are far more likely to get isolated, and so resilience for us is even more important than it might be for another community.
That was Allegra Starr, spokesperson for the Resource Assistance for Rural Environments program. By the way, this story was originally reported by Claire Carlson at the Daily Yonder.
Students at Parkrose High School in Northeast Portland are speaking out against a proposed diesel freight development across the street from their school. California-based company Prologis is trying to develop the former Kmart site at 122nd and Sandy into a hub for diesel truck-delivered goods, serving companies like Home Depot and Amazon. The Kmart burned down last summer, and toxic ash and smoke fell on neighboring areas. Students are upset they haven't been consulted or considered in the redevelopment process, especially because the project has the potential to impact them so immediately. The Parkrose neighborhood has disproportionately bad air quality compared to the rest of Portland because of its location near major diesel trucking and traffic routes. It is also one of the most ethnically diverse neighborhoods in the city. Last Wednesday, students in an environmental justice class held an environmental action fair and presented different ideas for the site, hoping to draw the attention of city and other local leaders. Sophomore Keely Quintero told the Portland Mercury she'd like to see some sort of grocery store at the site to help fill a gap in accessing healthy food. Other students said they'd like to see a community center, a houseless shelter, a food cart pod, a park, or an athletic facility across the street. Mo Yonamini started the environmental justice class. She said, quote, "A lot of students wanted an audience to have their voices come out of the school and have a bigger impact. The brilliance of their action ideas really came out from their lived experiences," end quote. Construction at the site is underway, while a legal appeal from various environmental groups to the Oregon Land Use Board of Appeals is supposed to be decided in the next few weeks. The appeal would halt construction.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with some rain showers and a low of 35. Some may see snow as the snow level drops to about 500 feet overnight. Tomorrow will be a lot like today, rainy with a high of 44. Today in history, in 1893, electrical engineer Nikola Tesla gives the first public demonstration of radio in St. Louis, Missouri. The quote of the day is from Nikola Tesla, who said, quote, "Our virtues and our failings are inseparable, like force and matter. When they separate, man is no more."
Congress again reaches a deal to avoid a partial government shutdown. Arizona Republicans want to ensure Trump remains on their state ballot. And Senate Democrats reintroduce the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. With those stories and more, it's Catherine Carley with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
This negotiation has been difficult, but to close the government down at a time like this would hurt people who should not be hurt.
Republican Congressman Chuck Fleischman of Tennessee says government shutdowns cause more harm than good. The House passed another short-term spending measure, which would avoid a shutdown this weekend and keep federal agencies running into March. President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump made dueling visits to the Texas border. In Brownsville, Biden touted a bipartisan immigration and border security deal. It would have toughened access for migrants, but was tanked by Republicans on orders from Trump.
The majority of Democrats and Republicans in both houses support this legislation until someone came along and said, don't do that, it'll benefit the incumbent.
Biden says he would be willing to shut down the border should the bipartisan legislation pass. Trump, meanwhile, traveled to Eagle Pass, where he called migrants terrorists. The IRS says with controversial new funding, it'll be able to go after more than 100,000 high earners who haven't filed going back to 2017. That could net hundreds of millions of dollars. The GOP-led Arizona Senate passed a bill saying presidential candidates can't be blocked from the ballot, even if they violated the Constitution's 14th Amendment ban on insurrectionists. Opponents say the bill would bypass the Constitution to protect Trump, but Republican Senator Jeanne Shump says it's not a partisan issue.
This is about the fact that we should be standing to make sure that the people are heard. And when the people put forward a nominee, political games should not have any interference.
Michigan Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib is urging voters in her state to consider the whole ballot in November rather than stay home in protest of Biden's handling of the war in Gaza.
Know that there's so many other folks on that ballot, many of which support a ceasefire, many city council members courageously proposing ceasefire resolutions.
More than 100,000 folks in Michigan voted uncommitted in this week's primary, and Democrats fear young voters won't turn out in November. Tlaib supports that protest, but says staying home simply makes those who want a ceasefire invisible. Biden told reporters Thursday a hostages for ceasefire deal probably won't be in place by Monday, as he had previously suggested. And Senate Democrats have reintroduced the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. It would require states with a history of discrimination return to having to get federal approval before changing voting rules. The bill previously died in the Senate when filibustered by Republicans, but Georgia Democrat Raphael Warnock says John Lewis was persistent, even when beaten nearly to death by police while marching for civil rights.
I think about John Lewis crossing that Edmund Pettus Bridge. He didn't have any reason to think that he could win, but with a trench coat on his back and commitment in his heart, he kept marching.
I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
This just in, moments ago, the Oregon Senate approved House Bill 4002, rolling back a major part of Measure 110 in a vote of 21-8. HB 4002 passed the House on Thursday with bipartisan support. Now the law heads to the governor's desk for signature. The bill recriminalizes drug possession of small amounts of illicit drugs with a new misdemeanor carrying penalties of up to 180 days in jail. Measure 110 had reduced this sort of drug possession to a Class E violation, punishable with a $100 maximum fine. Violators could have their charge dismissed by providing proof in court that they had obtained treatment within 45 days of the citation. HB 4002 has seen support from law enforcement and business leaders for closing gaps in Measure 110's apparent leniency toward drug offenders. Civil rights and BIPOC advocacy organizations have decried this decision. They point to the racial impact statement of the bill, which showed recriminalization would disproportionately impact Black Oregonians. They also point out that HB 4002 will overburden an Oregon judicial system already facing an unprecedented public defender shortage. House Bill 5204 also passed through the Senate today, heading to the governor's desk. HB 5204 is a budget companion of HB 4002. It directs $200 million to shovel-ready or pre-approved projects and programs. Also to trainings for behavioral health workers, medication-assisted treatment programs in jails, education, and increasing capacity in the criminal justice system.
A bill in Olympia would open access to unemployment while workers are on strike. But time is running out for lawmakers to pass this legislation. House Bill 1893 has made its way through the House, but it has to get approval from the Senate by the end of today. David Groves with the Washington State Labor Council says the bill would help level the playing field at the bargaining table.
Currently, employers can adopt a starve 'em out strategy where they refuse to negotiate in good faith because they know that their workers, especially when they earn low wages, aren't in a position to go without a paycheck.
The legislation would allow workers to access unemployment after 2 weeks on strike for a maximum of 4 weeks. Opponents say it would cost the state too much and could incentivize workers to strike. Last year was the most active year for labor activity and strikes in more than two decades. Groves says employers have too much control in bargaining.
This bill will promote good faith bargaining because it'll be a real possibility that workers could withhold their labor and go on strike, and that will give them the bargaining power they need to get a decent agreement to get better wages and working conditions.
Maine, New Jersey, and New York allow access to unemployment for striking workers. Washington's legislative session is scheduled to adjourn next Thursday.
In Anchorage, Alaska, Brian Smith was convicted of double murder of two Alaska Native women. While they are happy with the conviction, families and advocates say the need for change remains even after that trial. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. In the aftermath of Brian Smith's Anchorage murder trial, there are mixed emotions for the families and advocates of the two Alaska Native women he killed. As KMBA's Rhonda McBride reports, the trial may be over, but the need for change remains.
It took the jury less than 2 hours to convict Brian Smith on all 14 counts in the deaths of Kathleen Henry and Veronica Abouchuk. Both women were from small coastal villages. They battled addiction, struggled to survive on the streets of Anchorage. Vulnerabilities, prosecutors say, Smith preyed upon. Abouchuk's sister, Margie Lestenkoff, says the unusually quick verdict came as a relief.
We try to be strong in our heart, but still it hurts a lot. But we're happy that all the evidence were found.
Evidence that was overwhelming. Much of it focused on an SD card with footage that gave police the key to the case. Labeled homicide at Midtown Marriott, turned in by a sex worker who stole the killer's cell phone and copied footage of Kathleen Henry's last tortured moments alive. Only the jury, attorneys, and court staff saw the footage, but everyone else in the room heard the sound.
Hearing the gasping for air and you die, you live.
Golda Ingram, an advocate for Victims for Justice, said nothing in her experience prepared her for the trauma. But Ingram said it was healing to spend time with the Abouchuk family. She said their kindness and perseverance helped to restore the dignity of the victims. Lestenkoff says it was only fitting.
My sister Veronica, she was a real nice person. She never cussed. Didn't have a mean bone in her soul.
Abouchuk's daughter, Christy Grimaldi, says her mother's troubles began when she was molested by a priest as a child.
I learned that much older, but after that, I looked at my mother very differently.
Grimaldi's younger brother, Sean Henson, says all too many Native families have loved ones gone missing and murdered.
We're one piece of that puzzle.
Advocates for missing and murdered Indigenous people say the deaths of the two women forced the community to confront the horror of racial violence. The next step, they say, is to do something about it. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
The Iditarod Sled Dog Race gets underway this weekend with the ceremonial start in downtown Anchorage Saturday. The 1,000-mile race to Nome officially gets underway in Willow on Sunday. Last year, the top three finishers were all Alaska native. Ryan Reddington, an Inupiat with roots in Unalakleet, is the defending champ. His grandfather, Joe Reddington, was one of the founders of the Iditarod. Also returning, Pete Kaiser, a Yupik from Bethel, who took first place in 2019. Last year's third-place finisher, Richie Deal, an Athabascan from Aniak, did not enter this year's Iditarod. The race alternates between a southern and northern route. This year, 38 mushers are set to run the northern path. The race in recent years has averaged less than 9 days to finish. U.S. Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm announced funding for projects on tribal lands during her remarks at the Tribal Clean Energy Summit held this week in California. Some include solar projects with the Navajo Nation and Hopi Tribe in the Southwest and a hydro solar project with the Yakima Nation in Washington State, where solar panels will be positioned over irrigation canals, preserving environmental and cultural resources. Granholm announced more than $200 million in funding for 12 tribal projects. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Is marijuana bad for the climate? Indoor cannabis farms consume lots of electricity, boosting their carbon footprints. Dr. Anthony Leithwitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leithwitz, and this is Climate Connections. As a growing number of states legalize marijuana, cannabis businesses are ramping up. But cannabis is often grown in indoor farms under intense grow lights, and this setup can have a large carbon footprint.
Indoor-grown cannabis is using just a ton of electricity.
Jason Quinn of Colorado State University co-authored a study on how much energy it would take to grow cannabis indoors at various locations in each state, and the carbon pollution that would cause. The researchers found that in general, production is less polluting in areas with more clean power on the grid, and in mild climates where less energy is needed to maintain a farm's temperature and humidity. In the worst case, growing just 1 kilogram could emit as much carbon pollution as burning more than 500 gallons of gasoline. But in Long Beach, California, it would emit less than half that.
One of the challenges with it being federally regulated is that you can't transport cannabis across state lines.
But the study suggests that one way to reduce the industry's climate impact would be to concentrate farms in optimal growing areas. And when possible, avoid artificial lights and heat entirely.
And the easiest thing you can do is just grow it outside.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 1st, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we do encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories, tips, ideas at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Chris Gao, myself, Michelle Coppola, Reed Johnson, Sam Bowman, Jasmine, and Birdie. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Catherine Carley, and Shantaya Hudson. The director of Evening News is the affable Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH4.